Hello, my name is Dave Emery, and this is For the Record program number 514, a conversation with John Loftus about the Muslim Brotherhood, being recorded on June 12th of the year 2005. It is my pleasure and privilege to be joined here by John Loftus, a longtime federal investigator, author, and genuine American hero. John, welcome to our airwaves.
Well, thanks, Dave. I'll try and live up to the billing.
Okay, well, it's a tall billing, but I think you'll measure up very nicely. The Muslim Brotherhood. Can you tell us a little bit about your background and how it is that you came to become familiar with the Muslim Brotherhood?
Sure. I was a young lawyer. I worked for the Attorney General of the United States during the Carter and Reagan administrations, and I had above top secret clearance to view all the archives of the U.S. Intelligence Service. So for several years, I had done what nobody had done in 50 years, which is to compare all the information held by the various agencies. And sort of got an interesting point of view on how the world really works.
Now, the Muslim Brotherhood, can you give us some of its history and how that dovetailed with your research into some of the fascist freedom fighters and some of these Third Reich alumni?
Sure, Dave. I was working on Nazi war crimes at the Department of Justice, and, I came across an unusual series of files. And, in fact, years later, Bob Baer of CIA wrote a wonderful book called Sleeping with the Devil about Saudi Arabia, and he mentioned the Muslim Brotherhood and said, this was an important group in the history of terrorism and the Middle East, and he was amazed the CIA had only a very few pages on file for it. And I called him up and said, Bob, this isn't right. The CIA has, an encyclopedia-sized collection of files. This is an enormous group, and he had no idea what he was talking about. By the time that Bob Baer and the current generation of al-Qaeda experts came on the stage, all of the CIA's institutional memory had been erased. So what I'm about to tell you is something that not even the current agents at CIA know.
Okay.
All right, now, back in 1928, there was a young Egyptian fascist. His name was Hassan al-Banna. That's B as in boy, A-N-N-A. And al-Banna was a devout admirer of Adolf Hitler. In fact, by 1928, al-Banna had put together an Arab fascist organization called the Muslim Brotherhood. And, we know from the surviving letters that al-Banna wrote to Adolf Hitler that he was a devout admirer of the Third Reich, a fervent believer of Nazism. And what al-Banna proposed was to create an underground movement in all the Arab states to serve Nazism. This, of course, was a real boon to the intelligence services of the Third Reich. During the early 30s, it was decided to recruit al-Banna's movement and to fund him as an intelligence organization from Berlin.
And we should remember at this time the Middle East was dominated largely by the British.
Oh, yeah. And, Germany was looking to steal a march on the British and essentially to steal the Arab states right from under the British colonies.
Mm-hmm.
Now, al-Banna's job was to put together a mass movement of Arab Nazis. And this he did splendidly. By the end of World War II, he had 500,000 members, Arab Muslim members, who swore undying devotion to the principles of the Third Reich. Now, this is not just hyperbole. There are surviving records that prove that this happened. For example, al-Banna's forces swore that by the time that General Rommel reached Cairo, he wouldn't find a single British soldier left alive. The Muslim Brotherhood would rise up and kill him. They were truly a fifth column within the British colonies of the Arab world.
Mm-hmm.
The al-Banna's Arab Nazi movement was not just a spy movement, it was a guerrilla force, a political insurrectionist movement. A group of Iraqi Nazis, for example, were told they succeeded in overthrowing the British government in Iraq and turned Iraq into a Nazi colony. They would be the first Arab Nazi rulers in the Middle East. Among those Nazi revolutionaries, by the way, was Saddam Hussein's uncle, the man who raised him. And this is a theme we're going to return to fairly often, that a lot of the current rulers of the Middle East were directly the scions of the Arab Nazi movement.
By the way, Saddam's uncle was Khairullah al-Tufa, a name familiar to listeners. Go ahead, John.
So, the revolt, of course, was suppressed. The Arab Nazi movement was crushed. Rommel never made it to Cairo. But at the end of World War II, the Arab Nazis were not put on trial, either as collaborators or as war criminals. And some of them were pretty egregious. There was, for example, the representative of the Muslim Brotherhood in Palestine, the Grand Mufti of Jerusalem, whose clansman was a young man named Yasser Arafat.
Mm-hmm.
The Grand Mufti was a devout Nazi. Hitler's favorite Arab was the phrase often used for him. And he was brought to Berlin. He helped raise the first Muslim fascist army. It was under the guise of the Croatian fascists, but it really was to bring together as an umbrella group for bringing in Muslim fascists from all over the world. The Grand Mufti at the end of World War II was captured by French intelligence, and the Arab Nazis went underground. And that's where the story begins to take a real sickening twist. Instead of prosecuting the Arab Nazis, the British Secret Service made a decision to recruit them. Now, the entire Arab Nazi movement of the Muslim Brotherhood went underground, and the British were putting them on the payroll. They even kept the same German intelligence officers, the propagandists, the advisors that had run and coordinated the Muslim Brotherhood during World War II. All went on the British payroll. The Grand Mufti request was made to French intelligence to spring him from the French jail. He was allowed to, quote, escape and made his way back to Cairo. All the Arab Nazis made their way back to Egypt right after World War II. When the rest of the world was hunting down the Eastern European Nazis, the Arab Nazis were getting a free ride. They were getting a ticket home from the British Secret Service.
And what was the purpose of this?
Well, it was twofold. The primary method was that, you know, on paper at least, the British wanted to make use of the Arab fascist movement as a counterweight to the Arab communists. They wanted to have their own underground army to offset what Stalin was doing in recruiting, you know, Arab communists and Marxists. The truth was that the senior British intelligence officer behind the recruitment of the Arab Nazis was Kim Philby. Kim Philby was a Soviet double agent, and just as he had done with the European Nazis, Philby's mission was to protect the Arab Nazis under orders from Stalin. Because from the communist point of view, there was no better instrument for infiltrating Western intelligence than the Nazi movement. Who better, who would be least suspect of being among the ultra-left than the ultra-right?
And just parenthetically, listeners have heard the name Jack Philby, an associate of the Grand Mufti, who was Kim's father.
And Jack Philby was the extremely corrupt guy who was a British intelligence agent in Palestine, quit the British Secret Service, became a Muslim, moved to Saudi Arabia, helped smuggle the guns in to launch the Saudi uprising against the British. And as soon as the Saudis were in power, Jack Philby's first mission was to make sure that his true sponsors, the Arab American Oil Company, had signed contracts with the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia. So Jack was essentially a whore for oil money.
Mm-hmm. And
Kim Philby despised him and became a communist.
Right.
Well, anyway, in this complex world, we have Kim Philby, the son, and Jack Philby, the Arab fascist. Jack, by the way, spent some time in British prisons during World War II as a Nazi. So in 1945, the Arab Nazis are secretly revived, and the mission of the Muslim Brotherhood has changed. Under the direction of the Grand Mufti and the others, they are to be smuggled into Palestine, and they're to smash the infant state of Israel. The British army can't go in and slaughter Jews. It would be bad press, but they could use their Arab Nazi movement to do it for them. And that's essentially what happened. Unfortunately, the Arab Nazis lost. They retreated back to Egypt in 1948. Israel survived and became an independent state in 1948. And all of a sudden, the Egyptian political movement began to be nervous about this huge 500,000 army of Arab Nazis living in their midst, and rightfully so. So I think it was by 1952, Nasser decided to throw the Egyptian Nazis out, to ban the Muslim Brotherhood, and they were expelled from Egypt. Now, unfortunately, in 1952, the bunch of dimwits in the U.S. government thought, well, if the British aren't going to hire these guys, we will. And a small group of rogue officials inside the U.S. government later became part of CIA. They took over the Arab Nazis from the British Secret Service and brought the Muslim Brotherhood to safety in Saudi Arabia. Now, the Saudis were kindred spirits. Indeed, they were part of the Arab Nazi movement. The Kingdom of Saudi Arabia was pro-Nazi all during the war. They only stayed away from the Axis side because they were bribed by Franklin Roosevelt. Saudi Arabia was the only neutral country to receive lend-lease aid during World War II. You know, the House of Saud was never above a good bribe now and then.
Mm-hmm.
So instead of being on, you know, overtly on the Nazi side, covertly the Saudis kept smuggling oil to Hitler's forces, despite their promises to the American president. But the Saudis were very receptive to the idea of bringing in like-minded Arabs from around the world. Now, inside Saudi Arabia, their official religion is something called Wahhabism. And Wahhabism is, how can I put this gently, a despicable cult. Islam is a very gentle, pacifistic faith, but Wahhabism is to Islam as the Ku Klux Klan is to Christianity. Wahhabism has been declared a heresy more than 60 times by Islam before 1900. This is a vile, despicable sect that hates women, hates democracy, hates Jews, hates Western culture, and they found a really strong kindred spirit with the Arab Nazis and the Muslim Brotherhood.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there was a strong syncopation between the religious bigotry of the House of Saud and the indigenous racism of the Arab Nazis. And they found their perfect merger in Saudi Arabia. Now, the Saudis gave the Arab Nazis jobs as teachers at the madrasas, the religious schools. And there they influenced an entire new generation of young Saudi nationals, among whom was a young man named Osama bin Laden. Now, the original concept was that from the British was that the Arab Nazis would be used as a counterweight to the Arab communists during the Cold War. And, you know, occasionally the CIA used them, but really by the 1980s, it was time to take the Arab Nazis out of the closet. In 1979, the Russians had taken over Afghanistan, and it was time, the last time, to play the Arab Nazi card. So what happened is that our CIA asked it wasn't the CIA, it was sort of one of these rogue groups that we set up under the wings of the White House using some CIA personnel and military cover, but no one agency really knew what was going on. But essentially, U.S. taxpayers' dollars were being laundered through Saudi Arabia to hire the Arab Nazis to send them into Afghanistan to go kill Russians.
Right.
And for a 10-year period, it was a very successful operation. And by 1989, the Russians were driven out of Afghanistan, the CIA declared victory, and went home. And they washed their hands of the Arab Nazis. But they left this huge army of Arab Nazis in the field. Now, of course, they weren't called Arab Nazis then. They weren't even called the Muslim Brotherhood. They had changed their name to the Mujahideen because the Muslim Brotherhood was too well known as a Nazi organization. But essentially, the heart of the Mujahideen was always the same Arab Nazi leaders that had fought with Hitler during World War II.
Who oversaw the program for the... They were called the MAK, were they not? Was that the formal title?
The Mujahideen al-Khak. Yeah, they were the... Al-Khidmat. They were the... the service organization, if you will. And they were overseen by the Pakistani intelligence service, the ISI, and the Saudi government, funded by CIA, sort of with a wink. And the CIA always told Congress, we never knew who was on the payroll. But they knew. They knew.
How does the elder George Bush fit into this?
He was, the vice president of the United States and head of CIA at a time when all these policies were going underway. It's going to be hard to tell the truth of who knew what and where because so many of the files have been shredded inside CIA. But your listeners can have a little fun if you want to find out exactly what happened. Type these two words into a Google search, BANA, B as in boy, BANA, B-A-N-N-A, and Nazi. And it'll kick out about 20 articles that you'll find extremely interesting. And it's all the things that have been shredded from the Central Intelligence Agency.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, by 1989... The CIA declared victory, they went home, and here was this army of, second-generation Nazis and first-generation Nazis still in the field. And the Saudis didn't want them to come home. Now, at the same time, a revolution was going on inside the Mujahideen al-Khak. There was a group around Osama bin Laden. They wanted to become even more fanatical. They wanted to return to their old Nazi roots, if you will. So they assassinated Azam, who was the more moderate leader of the Mujahideen, and they began to winnow out who would be loyal enough. And they made a checklist from the roster of the MAK. And the people who had a check mark beside their name were called the base of the organization, the base. And the Arab word for the base is Al-Qaeda. And that's where the organization came from. It came directly from the Mujahideen al-Khidmat. It was the Arab Nazi movement's second generation. Not that they were far removed. This isn't, you know, some stretch of, you know, deconstructionist history. For example, the chief of staff, if you will, of al-Qaeda was a man named Dr. al-Zawahiri.
Mm-hmm.
And Dr. al-Zawahiri was the leader of a splinter group of the Muslim Brotherhood called the Egyptian Islamic Jihad. The Muslim Brotherhood, of course, as you know, most terrorist organizations will over a period of time, had split off various factions. There was the EIJ, the Egyptian Islamic Jihad, that became al-Qaeda. There was the PIJ, the Palestinian Islamic Jihad, that's headed by Dr. Sami Al-Aryan, a fellow I've been hunting who's now standing trial here in Florida.
Mm-hmm.
There was Hamas, which was headed by Sheikh Rantisi, who was assassinated by the Egyptians, and his Cairo obituary revealed that he was the Palestinian head of the Muslim Brotherhood. Hamas was, in essence, a secret front group, if you will.
Correction, John, he was assassinated by the Israelis, right? Not the Egyptians.
I'm sorry, the Israelis.
Go ahead. Pardon
you. Assassinated by the Israelis. But the Cairo obituary made it very clear that the Hamas terrorist group in Israel was nothing more than a front group for the Muslim Brotherhood. They were all coordinated. So there's several of these modern front organizations are really nothing more than various splinter factions descended from the original Nazi organization, the Muslim Brotherhood. And when you think about it, groups like al-Qaeda and the Nazis had very much in common. They both hated Jews.
Mm-hmm.
They hated Western democracy. And they hated the whole idea of, you know, liberal culture. They were anathema to democracy, to Western civilization, and particularly to Jews. So you could look at, Hassan al-Banna's movement of 1930 and the al-Qaeda movement of 2001 and find direct ideological connections between the two. I think it's fair to say that the bulk of the al-Qaeda philosophy comes directly from the Nazi movement, and the importance of that is seen by the preeminence of Dr. al-Zawahiri, who was a Muslim Brotherhood leader himself.
You mentioned Sami al-Aryan. In one of our previous discussions, you related to us how your investigations of Sami al-Aryan led to the Operation Green Quest raids of March of 2002. Can you recap that for us and set that forth for newer listeners who may not have heard that interview?
Sure. I've been approached by some of my friends in the CIA and FBI, and I said, look, we are not allowed to touch terrorists in America because most of them are funded by the Saudis. And the Saudis have a front group, a charitable headquarters, if you will, at 555 Grove Street, Herndon, Virginia. And from this little site, the Saudis had 50 little charitable organizations, and they were literally funding terrorist front groups in the U.S. that laundered money to the Middle East to kill Jews, kill Americans, kill anyone that they wanted to. The Saudis were getting American tax deductions for funding terrorism right from this own country. And everybody in the U.S. government knew about it. And they're all saying, yeah, we knew the Saudis were funding terrorism, but, you know, they were selling us oil at a discount. Besides, they were only killing Jews. They weren't killing Americans. Well, that kind of bigoted indifference all faded after 9/11. And a number of people came and said, John, you got to help us. We've got to do something about it. We're not allowed to embarrass the Saudi government. I said, I don't mind embarrassing the Saudis. What I did was I chose to donate money to Sami al-Aryan's terrorist charities in Florida. Because I knew that under Florida law, I could sue Professor al-Aryan and say, I want to find out where my money went. Did it go to a legitimate charitable purpose, or did you spend it on terrorism? Well, my lawsuit, I drew up a very lengthy civil complaint, and quite frankly, I had access to all the classified files in the U.S. government and other countries about Sami al-Aryan, and I submitted them all in a very long complaint. Because of my security clearances, I had to submit it all back to the Justice Department and CIA and FBI beforehand. And it caused a bit of an uproar because I stated, quite frankly, in the complaint that the U.S. government had known for decades that terrorists like Sami al-Aryan were in the United States killing people overseas and not doing anything about it because they're being protected because of the Saudis. So the CIA loved it. They said, John, go ahead, file the complaint. We love it. A couple of days later, a couple of FBI agents showed up at my front door and said, how did you learn about this? There were only 21 people in the U.S. government that knew some of this stuff, and now you're 22. I said, I'm sorry, I can't tell you attorney-client privilege. They were sort of miffed, but it's the law is the law. The day before I went to file the lawsuit, I got a frantic phone call from my old bosses in the U.S. Department of Justice. And they said, John, please don't file the lawsuit tomorrow. Give us more time. We're really going to raid the Saudi charities. I said, I know you will. You told me that in January and again in February. And now it's March. You want more time? I'll give you more time. You get till 4 o'clock tomorrow.
Go ahead.
So, much moaning and gnashing of teeth. I said, basically, I'll file my complaint in the morning, and you will, but I'll keep the Saudi address out to give you time to raid it. So I filed my complaint at 10 o'clock. At 10:15, the U.S. government launched Operation GreenQuest, a massive raid precisely at the address listed in my complaint, 555 Grove Street, Herndon, Virginia. And in 1 hour, we shut down the entire Saudi money laundering system for terrorism in America. Because from this address, the Saudis were funding Hamas, Hezbollah, all these front group charities in America, the Holy Land Foundation in Texas, the Benevolent Foundation in Chicago. The whole network the Saudis had been set up for funding terrorism collapsed.
And this in conjunction with the Muslim Brotherhood that had been relocated there in the early 50s by elements of CIA.
The CIA had no idea what's going on anymore because the files had all been destroyed.
Sure.
But as I began out this information, people began to go, oh, that's what's going on. So a lot of the old-timers from, you know, British intelligence and German intelligence and Israeli intelligence began to help fill in the pieces. So we began to really fill in the puzzle that for years there had been this corrupt organization run by the Saudis, and our oil companies had lobbied the U.S. government to turn a blind eye. You know, both Republicans and Democrats have pretended it wasn't happening.
How does Youssef Nada and the Bank al-Taqwa fit into the Muslim Brotherhood chronology that you've given us?
Great question. Youssef Nada, the Bank al-Taqwa, they were, you know, original World War II Nazis, and they funded the Nazis movement, the Arab Nazis, the Muslim Brotherhood. They were funding al-Qaeda. They were put on the banned list by the U.S. Now, ironically, here's something interesting, Dave.
Mm-hmm.
The U.S. government refused to supply evidence to the Swiss trial of Bank al-Taqwa. No documents, no witnesses, no evidence. And 2 weeks ago, the entire trial of the Bank al-Taqwa collapsed in Switzerland for lack of evidence. So this the war within the U.S. government. Most of the U.S. government is desperately trying to fight al-Qaeda.
Mm-hmm.
There's a small faction trying to cover up their connection to the Arab Nazi movement.
Recalling briefly for listeners, in the Asia Times series from the spring of 2002, it alleges that Youssef Nada actually helped the Grand Mufti escape from Germany at the end of World War II and head to Palestine, and that Nada himself actually worked for the Third Reich and the Abwehr Intelligence Service. How does Grover Norquist and his Islamic Institute fit into the concatenation we've been talking about?
Grover Norquist has been denounced by conservative Republicans as the terrorist lobbyist in America. And Grover was stunned. He said, what do you mean, terrorist lobbyist? Well, the two of them, we had Professor Sami Al-Aryan, who, you know, was, Grover Norquist was his hero, because Al-Aryan convinced Norquist that Al-Aryan could deliver the state of Florida for George Bush in the first and second Bush elections. That if Norquist gave Al-Aryan the backing and support, Al-Aryan would turn out a significant enough of an Arab vote to offset the Jewish vote in Florida, and Florida would go narrowly for Bush. And Al-Aryan had his price. He wanted Norquist to lobby the FBI to back off investigations of Arab Americans. And the FBI fell for it. Hook, line, and sinker. Grover Norquist has extraordinary power. I think he's one of the ten most powerful men inside the Beltway. One of his best friends is the White House Chief of Staff, Karl Rove. And Norquist put pressure on the FBI to stop investigating Arab Nazis, to back away, you know, and the FBI leadership became politically correct, something they'd never done towards African Americans or Jewish Americans. But when it came to Arab Americans, oh my goodness. The FBI suddenly became deaf, dumb, and blind when it came to investigations of Arab. And that's not the FBI out in the field. The FBI agents in the field were still tracking terrorism and couldn't understand why they couldn't get approval for subpoenas from Washington or wiretaps of Washington. Every time they tried, you know, guys like Grover Norquist were ahead of them. And Sami Al-Aryan even threw a dinner for Grover Norquist and gave him an award for the work that he had done for Arab-American privacy. What a farce.
And Norquist, one of the most powerful right-wing lobbyists in all of Washington, D.C.
Oh, sure. He's the guy that brought you Newt Gingrich. He's the consultant behind the scenes for the NRA, for taxpayers from America. He is the leader of the ultra-right. Grover Norquist is the person, I think, who single-handedly destroyed bipartisanship. Norquist called bipartisanship another form of date rape. He said that you know, he does not want to have consensus. He wants to set Democrats and Republicans at each other's throats. He's a man who single-handedly has destroyed a significant part of the fabric that holds America together. I think he's a despicable man. But to be fair, Grover Norquist didn't know that he was working with terrorists. He was just a dope. I mean, it wasn't just Al Arian that had him conned. Another man, Alamudi, was donating money to Grover Norquist to set up this Islamic Institute to fund all these wonderful research things. We're going to have Islamic chaplains serving the U.S. government and in prisons, and we're going to have Islamic people hired by the White House to screen Muslims coming to the White House. Well, the problem with all this is that, of course, is that Alamudi was just another terrorist, and like Sami Al Arian, he's been indicted and he's pled guilty, in fact. But, you know, those are the clients that Grover Norquist had. He was the terrorist lobbyist. And but Grover Norquist had so much power that he was able to influence even the White House. Several of his Norquist proteges became White House staff. And, well, the bottom line is, whether, you know, people knew what they were doing or not, is that moderate Muslims, good, decent Muslim Americans, couldn't get in to see the president. Only right-wing terrorists like Alamudi and Al Arian could. They were the ones who got their pictures taken with Bush. Bush had no idea what was going on because he was listening to his chief of staff, Karl Rove, and Karl Rove didn't know what was going on because he was listening to Grover Norquist, and Grover Norquist didn't know what was going on because he was listening to Al Arian and Alamudi. So Grover Norquist probably did the most harm of any lobbyist in America and didn't have a clue that he was doing.
And this entire concatenation evolved from the 1928 conception, of the Muslim Brotherhood in Egypt by Hassan Al-Banna.
Sami Al Arian was the Western Hemisphere chief of the Muslim Brotherhood faction, the PIJ, the Palestinian Islamic Jihad. His organization is one of the direct splinter groups right from the Muslim Brotherhood. They are as Arab Nazi as you can get. So the Arab Nazis came home 50 years later and found a friend in the White House.
John, very quickly, give us your website. We're almost out of time here.
Sure. It's john-loftus.com, and my new project is the intelligencesummit.org. I'm trying to put together an international meeting on President's Day weekend in Washington where we're going to have people from every intelligence organization in the free nations come together to share information about the way the world really works.
And in addition to John Loftus' website, be aware, too, that John is the author of, among other titles, The Belarus Secret, Unholy Trinity, about which we will be speaking at some point in the not-too-distant future, I hope, John, and the Secret War Against the Jews, about which we've spoken at considerable length in the past. John, thanks so much for visiting with us, and thanks so much for your life's work and your heroism.
You're very kind, David. Thank you.
All righty. We have been speaking with John Loftus, former Justice Department investigator and the author of, among other titles, Belarus Secret, Unholy Trinity, and The Secret War Against the Jews. For John Loftus, this is Dave Emery saying you've been listening to For the Record program number 514, recorded on June 12th of 2005. Thanks for listening.